Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in today. And if you have a question about an insect, maybe a bug that's bugging you, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Phil, good to have you back.
Nice to be back.
We had this fellow from Mesa, Arizona, saying that the biggest problems with insects in the country are from mosquitoes, termites, ants, cockroaches, and bees.
He's not a gardener. I mean, that perspective is what a lot of pest control people will tell you, that, you know, it differs in different parts of the country. I mean, ants are always a big one around here. Mosquitoes, is, you know, it just depends on the given year. Fleas used to be more of a problem than they are now because of some of these products that we have to treat the dogs. Roaches, well, maybe if you're, you know, in student housing, but, you know, in generally in Wisconsin, roaches are really not that frequent. So I know where he's coming from, but that's his perspective. And as I said, you know, if we came up with a list here, we'd be starting talking about Japanese beetle and a few other critters, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned college kids, and this there were warnings out in Madison last weekend about taking upholstered furniture from the curbs as people moved in and out of residences. Of course, the concern is about bringing insects like bed bugs via the furniture into your own place.
Yeah, I'd read that. I guess my comments is, I mean, it's very, you're always taking a risk when you get used furniture, whether you buy it at some place and the like. And, you know, stuffed furniture is particularly difficult to disinfect. But even nightside stands and, you know, any of that material has a potential. And with bed bugs being so difficult to control now because of the chemical resistance, I think that's very wise. We worry about bed frames and mattresses first, but couches, stuffed chairs. But as I said, I've seen a number of cases, too, where it's something that's just a little wooden nightside stand you'd think would be pretty innocent, but they're up in the cracks and seams there, and you can introduce them in your home that way.
Well, lots of callers. Let's go to Gigi in Viroqua. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'd like to know what bit me. I was sitting in the city of Viroqua under a maple tree, and something landed on my hand, and I saw it. It was like a little tiny stick, like a fourth of an inch or less, with legs. And it sat there, and it bit me, and then I brushed it away, and I got a red welt, and it hurt a lot.
Okay. Well, I'm guessing it's a true bug. There's a couple stilt-like assassin bugs that would somewhat fit that. And there's a couple others, but these are basically predators. And so they use that biting mouth part to paralyze and capture their prey. And although they typically don't go out of their way to bite people, at times when they do, I would expect a little bit of a reaction. Both you feel the bite initially. It's not painless by it. In fact, sometimes it's very painful. But if they get a chance to inject any of their saliva, you would expect a reaction. But that's all it is, a localized reaction. There's nothing dangerous about it. It's not like they're putting, you know, toxins and things into you. But it can be an unpleasant experience if, you know, you get picked.
Absolutely.
An ambush bug or some of these items.
What was the name of it?
Well, I'm guessing it was probably a stilt-legged assassin bug, if I had to give you a wild guess. If not that, it had to be probably some type of true bug that's predacious.
So a stilt-legged
assassin bug.
Assassin bug. There you have it. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Brad in Lake Geneva. Hi, Brad.
Hello. I've got these very strange little critters that come in under the foundation. They're about an inch long. They have many, many legs, a couple of antennae. They move in an undulating motion. And they come in droves. And they crawl inward, and they die all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And they curl up into a tiny little ball and die.
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing, and why are they coming in?
They're millipedes. And millipedes are creatures that feed on organic matter in the soil, and they're mostly active at night. And especially in the late summer and fall, we get this kind of mass migration, and they're out cruising around, we think, just looking for greener pastures. But when the sun comes up, they look for places that are cool, damp, and dark, which often gets them accumulating on cement slabs or crawling under crawl spaces and foundations. If they make their way in the house, there's nothing to eat. It's too dry an environment, so they often die in very short order. But we have people at this time of the year and into September that will tell you they can literally fill a, you know, 2-gallon bucket with dead millipedes daily. But in those cases, usually what you find is that it's not the mowed part of the lawn, but they have next to them a big, you know, prairie or CRP ground, someplace that's got a lot of organic matter in the soil. That's where the millipedes have been breeding, and now they're kind of spilling over. The good news is they're harmless. We often talk about tightening the house as best one can so they can't squeeze their way in. If you do treatments, you know, we talk about barrier treatments where you spray around the outside foundation. But in this case, I like the idea that if you know where they're coming from, you know, that this long grass prairie is on the north side of your property, I think it's more effective to treat the edge from where you stop mowing to where this starts. So you stop them there rather than allowing them getting all the way to the house. And there are various landscape sprays and whatnot, even granules in some cases can be used if that's the direction you want to go.
My house has a particularly large amount of styrofoam insulation on the outside. Do they do any damage to that?
Not on purpose.
No.
But to be honest, you know, if they can squeeze underneath things, you may see some small holes in it, but it's not like they can drill through it. They really don't have the mouth parts for it. So generally not, but I could see a case where there's a little bit of opening they're going to try to squeeze in, and that may cause a little bit of problem.
So it's just the nuisance factor that we do.
Yep.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Well, Phil, we have listeners all over the world, actually. They listen online and so forth. And here we have Matthew, who lives in Brazil, emailed us. And the home I live in has a fairly high number of hanging nests. It's in form of paper wasp, I'm sure. I'm trying to convince others that these are actually beneficial. They hunt other critters, harmful to our gardens. But they're not very interested in hearing about that possibility. What exactly are the benefits? In other words, what do paper wasps hunt, kill, eat?
Sure. Well, it turns out some of the species feed on caterpillars, which are often pests of our vegetables and trees. Many of them also are predators on flies. And so they'll go in and collect them. And so really across the board, they have to be eating some other insect material in. Many of those insects are things that are at least a nuisance, if not downright a pest. So he's very right that they are beneficial in that status. The only concern is that if you disturb the nest in a manner, then they get very defensive, and because they can sting, it can be an issue. And so, you know, much like, and this is the time of the year we're getting a lot of those calls around here. If the nest is, you know, 15 feet up in a tree, it's definitely best to leave it be. And what happens here is they freeze out. If the nest is right outside the front door and somebody has a potential of bumping into it, that's where you get concerned because, as I said, then they're usually not aggressive at all, but if the nest is threatened, they do become aggressive, and then you have the opportunity to get stung. So it depends where the nests are hanging. If they're out of the way, I think he's very right. Tell people they're nothing but good. But if indeed they're a place where somebody might bump into them, then we do have to sometimes remove them or treat them.
And along the same veins here, Muriel emailed us from Wisconsin, has a gray paper wasp nest that they decided to leave alone because it was in and out of the way area. Thought it'd be fun to watch the activity. But then a friend told them that there was a certain kind of wasp, she couldn't remember which kind, that killed honeybees, which we like and have many of. We think we have yellow jacket wasps and are now wondering if we should have removed the nest when it
sure.
was very small.
There are some worldwide, some wasps that are predaceous on honeybees, but nothing to worry about here. And so, yeah, I think they're just fine to leave it be. You know, it's interesting. This has been a relatively speaking quiet wasp year. You know, the German yellow jacket that gets to be such a scavenger for people food in the late summer has been pretty few and far between. That seems to be common in cooler years, that they don't scavenge till later, but their population seemed to be down pretty much statewide, although I did talk to a gentleman a couple of weeks ago in Wisconsin Rapids who gave me the impression that they were really very numerous in that one particular spot, but everybody else I've been talking to, they've been pretty light.
We have some grape jelly feeders for our Baltimore Orioles still out because we still have the Orioles coming, and we're getting some of those yellow jackets coming to the jelly. So
yeah, well, they, you know, sugar or protein. They figure and they get into this problem with feeding their young and not enough food, so they become scavengers. And you know, people call them garbage bees and all kinds of things, but they're technically a European yellow jacket that's a ground nesting or void nesting species. So the nest is not out in the open. It's hiding someplace in the ground or in a wall.
Chris in Oshkosh, on to you. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hey, a very interesting show. Would like to learn more about how to attract mason bees because I hear they're good pollinators, but have a playset next to the garden, and are they defensive with the kids? And then could you talk a little bit more about the resistance of the bed bugs? And okay. I'll take my answer off here.
All right.
Mason bees, you know, there are on the internet a number of plans for designing little devices that attract mason bees. They're almost a straw-like device. In fact, there's a gentleman by the name of Eric Mader who has written a book on managing mason bees in Wisconsin and the like, and that I think you can find on the internet, and it goes into a lot of detail. We tell people, I mean, they are native to Wisconsin, and so if you provide the house, they will come, is the way to look at it. And you can also buy them commercially, but I think it's a better idea to try to work with the ones we have here. They're really very docile. I mean, like any bee, you know, if you're in a confined situation, they're capable of stinging, although we have some stingless bees in the state, too, so I don't want to give the impression that all bees sting, but again, very docile. There wouldn't be any problem at all, but that's much like honeybees. I mean, honeybees, just don't give us trouble. It's usually the yellow jackets and wasps that are more likely to sting people.
And Eric's name, again, was Eric, the
Mader.
Author? Mader?
M-A-D-E-R, I think.
Oh, Mader, okay.
Right.
And then the bed bugs?
Bed bugs... Well, you know, this phenomena has been growing for about the last 10 years. And early in my career, human bedbugs were very few and far between. Now, you know, if you've seen all the things on national news and New York Times and whatnot, it's constantly in front of people. And the issue is that the bedbugs have made this incredible resurgence. And one of the main reasons is that the typical pesticides that are registered to use indoors aren't working worth a darn. But they're all the same chemical, basically. They're all synthetic pyrethroid insecticides. And so if you become resistant to one, you have a resistance to others. This also probably has something to do that when DDT became available, it absolutely devastated the bed bugs. The way these pesticides work is in a similar manner. And so there's pretty strong evidence, I think, is that this is a cross-resistance factor, that the bed bugs would develop some resistance to DDT, so they already had the mechanisms to detoxify these newer products. So it's forcing people, both a couple things. We're learning about bed bugs, all kinds of interesting things, that in apartments they can move from unit to unit relatively easily. You have to be careful when you're traveling because it's so easily picked up at hotels. And then once you get them, the treatments are such that it probably isn't something the average homeowner can do themselves. This is one where you do need professional help, and you need some professional help that has experience because... as I said, it's not an easy matter, and you have to be incredibly thorough. And we're finding that some companies are using heat machines and other kinds of devices to come in and treat because the standard treatments aren't working, and they have to have multiple treatments, and it's an expensive treatment. So it's gotten to be a real problem area. And, you know, we have it in a number of places in Wisconsin, but there are places like New York City and the state of Ohio and whatnot that I'm hearing that are far worse than what we have. My take when I came back from the national meetings last year is bed bugs will inherit the earth, and there's nothing that we can do to stop them. Now, that's a little bit of an overplay, but again, it is becoming an issue that people, I think, need to be educated on because the potential is there. It's no longer a kind of a random poem that we all learned about when we were kids. The reality is they do exist. People argue sometimes, I call them indoor mosquitoes, to set the point that they do not really transmit diseases. They suck your blood. That's not nice, but on the other hand, it's not the end of the world. It has nothing to do with personal hygiene. It's just, unfortunately, you bring them in the situation and they take advantage of it.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take your insect question at 1-800-642-1234 or by emailing us at talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, and let's turn to Fred in Wisconsin Rapids. Fred, thank you for waiting.
Oh, thanks a lot, guys. We have a small log cabin on a lake in the UP, and we always have a problem in the fall with cluster flies. Mm-hmm. Last year we had a person, you know, come out commercially and spray the cabin, and we don't know if it was too early or not, but it didn't seem that effective. And any tips for dealing with cluster flies, and is there an optimum time to spray? Do you wait till you start seeing them on the outside of the cabin on the logs, before you spray, because we're afraid, too, if we spray a little bit too early, will the rain, you know, affect the spray?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So any tips we'll appreciate.
Yeah, I usually get concerned about the first week of September as far as the proper time. It seems that cluster flies sometimes start to move in before you really think that the cold weather's setting in. So, and, you know, the kind of sprays that the pest control services use, you can buy at the local Home Depot and whatnot. They're all synthetic pyrethroids in one form or another. If you're getting up there on a regular basis, I think it's reasonable to wait until you see the first cluster flies. But again, if I had to give you a magic date, it'd be about the 1st of September, which is a whole month earlier than when we have the Asian lady beetle problems. And if you're going to spray air high up in the overhangs and the higher parts of the logs, they generally don't move in the very low areas. If you watch them, they land on the outside. When the sun comes up in the morning, it kind of wakes them up and they start crawling upwards. And that's where they're starting to squeeze through. So that would be my advice.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry in Green Bay emailed us, and he says, I have numerous anthills all over my yard. I'm curious about how many colonies there are. For example, when I see half a dozen hills within a few inches of each other, are there multiple entrances to one colony, or is there one queen and one colony per hill? That's an interesting question, too.
In the bigger field ant colonies, I see multiple entrances. But usually you can define the one nest or a couple right next, you know, a couple areas right next to you, and there's an area maybe in the middle of no activity. Sometimes you can also get a little bit of a hint on how the ants react to each other because, in generally, even though the ants are the same species, they're not overly tolerant of nests too close by. It's just a competition thing that goes on. So my guess is more likely than not, there are some of these big field ant nests, which can be 3-4 feet wide and have multiple entrances. That particular ant only has one queen. As does most of our native ants, it seems it's more of these invasive tropical ants that we get into the multiple queen scenarios. And most of those are more likely to be indoor nesters or potentially nest both indoors and outdoors.
And let's turn to Peter in Madison. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Phil and Larry.
Hi.
Yeah, I had a question. I'm standing in the garden looking at some asters and daisies, and I see a bug I don't think I've seen before. It's acting just like a bee. It's kind of golden tan, and it's got a black and white striped abdomen. Kind of looks like a box elder bug, except for the colorings. And it's got two black spots towards the rear end of the wing covers.
Okay.
I'm wondering what that sounds like.
With the two black spots, I'm suspicious there's an animal that we call a soldier beetle. It's quite common on goldenrod and asters in the late summer. It's a soft wing beetle. So, you know, most beetles you think of hard and crunchy, and these guys are quite soft. Long black antennae?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the way you describe the striping on the abdomen and whatnot, I think they're soldier beetles. They're just pollen feeders and nothing to worry about.
Oh, good. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Back to the field ants for a minute. Someone is wondering, when is the best time to attack field ants in your yard, the anthills?
Well, because those ants' colonies can live for 10 to 12 years, really any time that the ground's not frozen would be appropriate. And we've talked about this on the show before, that the whole secret is to know where the nest is. Well, that's obvious with these. But secondly, to kill the queen. And because she's deep in the ground, the mistake that most people make is they tend to surface treat the nest and not get stuff deep enough to be effective. And so, you know, my recommendation normally is to get some kind of metal rod or pole that you can put 3 or 4 good channels. You push it down as far as you can. And because they've been working the ground, it's usually pretty loose and you can get down 10, 12, 15 inches quite easily. And then rather than using a sprayer, I usually, you know, most garden insecticides have ants on the label. You mix it up to the normal dilution rates in a bucket, though. And for a big nest, it might take a half a gallon or even a gallon or more of mixed dilute product and then pour it on so it soaks deep. That's what it's all about, is moving this stuff down. And so, you know, one would argue you do it in the spring and you knock the colonies out for the rest of the year. So that probably makes a little more sense. But if you don't get around to it till now, it doesn't matter. If you don't get around to it, as I said, you expect that ant colony to be present in that site for a number of years.
Someone else wondered, why is it that when you kill the queen, everybody else dies?
because they're all sterile females. I mean, an ant colony, what we call workers, are all sterile females. Males are only produced when the colony is strong enough, and they go through this swarming phenomenon where they produce new queens, new males, and they don't stick around. They go and fly. And you, in fact, this is going to be happening, and it's already happening to some degree. Late afternoons in the summer, late summer, early fall, you'll walk out in your yard, and you just see clouds of ants bubbling up. Well, those are ants swarming. What they're supposed to do is find a mate from some other colony, and then they start everything from scratch. And so it's an interesting phenomenon, and usually it's very much tied into a certain part of the day. Late afternoon, they're there for 2 hours. You come back at 8 o'clock at night, everybody's gone. Come back the next morning, everybody's gone. But lo and behold, that same time in the afternoon, especially a nice sunny day, they're out swarming. So the swarming phenomenon will often go on for a week or more. Often sometimes it'll even show you where you had nests that you were not aware of it. But those kind of ants are usually either cornfield or field ants. Those are not the kind of ants that typically come indoors. They don't hurt the lawn. And so, you know, the only time we get concerned about them is if the mounds get big enough that you can't get the lawnmower over them, those kind of things.
Let's go to John in Minocqua now. John, hello.
How are you, Larry? First time caller, long time listener.
Well, great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, up here in northern Wisconsin, we have so much sand in the soils. I'm in construction, long-term job, and I find that every time I'm around the foundations or we're in the sandy areas around the beaches, people up here call them no-see-ums. They also call them sand fleas. I want to know what the heck they are. My son and I both have the same allergic reaction. If we get bit, I mean, this thing is smaller than a 32nd of an inch. You can barely see them, but you'll see a swarm of them, and when we get bit, size of a softball sometimes on your elbow, your arm, wherever they get bit. How toxic are they? And I mean, is there any long-term solution to help me get a little alleviation of this problem?
Okay. Well, what an entomologist calls a no-see-um is a small gnat, smaller than a fruit fly, that tends to be found in areas of the edges of ponds in other, you know, almost swampy-like environments. And the adults are very weak flying, but they are a blood-feeding critter. And when they do bite you, because they leave salivary components behind, it's kind of like a mosquito bite. But I guess I would say in comparison, for people that are sensitive to it, it lasts longer and it itches worse. And so people that go down to Florida all the time complain about sand fleas. There is no such thing as a true sand flea. That's usually what they have are these no-see-ums, or another name for them is punkies. And what's interesting is often you don't feel the bite initially, but then this reaction will show up in a matter of a couple hours to even maybe as much as 12 hours afterwards.
And, I mean, it gets hot. It actually physically gets hot to the touch. So I can't believe the toxic ability of this tiny little insect. Amazing.
Well, but it's really your body that's responding to it, because there's nothing inherent in it that makes it, you know, a nasty toxin. In fact, again, its interest only is sucking blood like a mosquito. But as I said, you know, for individuals, we have similar reactions to black flies, which are another biting gnat, a little bit bigger creature, a little bit more of a spring creature for most of us, where people will get the bites. You can see them bleed, and then in very short order, you develop this hard welt like somebody hit you with a pipe. And often will take a few days to settle down. You'll notice on very windy days, you don't see them because they're such weak flyers, they can't hold up. But generally, again, not so much the sand, but when you get into damp areas, or as I said, if you get down close to a lake that has kind of some, you know, more marshy, mucky areas right on the side, because it's that interface between the water and the ground where it's kind of soft and mucky is where the larvae of these no-see-ums are typically found.
Well, it's a good thing we think we rule the planet, but I hate to say it, but I think the insects do.
So. Oh, they definitely do. There's no doubt about that.
Thanks, John. Good luck. That's a pretty big reaction.
Yeah, that's somewhat unusual. Although, as I said, people that are sensitive to it, that come back from Florida, you know, show me the welts 2 weeks later, and they still have a very defined, you know, bite, which is pretty nasty for something that, again, is really small. They're half the size of a fruit fly.
Bob in Washington Island, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a cabin up here on the island, and the problem is it's painted white. And spiders tend to crawl up and down by the windows, and they leave this trail. And we wondered if there's some kind of way we can keep the spiders from crawling all over the house. with without using chemicals. Someone said if you sprinkle Comet around, it helps. But have any ideas?
I don't know of any defined, scientifically proven repellent of spiders. Part of the problem when you're close to water is there's so many insects coming off the water, and then with lighting and again the lighthouse, the insects are attracted to it, and that's what spiders are taking advantage of. It's a great restaurant for them, and so we definitely have a lot more spider pressure in homes that are located next to a source of water, and again that are light colored. The Comet, you know, you can get some short-term repellency from things, but I don't think that will hold up. All the times I've seen studies on these kind of home remedies, they've turned out to be pretty disappointing when they're looked at closely. So other than, again, using a residual-type product...
Keeping their lights off at night, I suppose.
Yeah, well, the other thing, we talk sometimes to people, and this is something that we really do more for, you know, food manufacturers and the like, that, you know, the need for security lighting, we understand, but think of the difference between having the light on in front of your door, back door, and drawing all the bugs to that, which the spiders take advantage of, or taking that light, putting it on a post, shining it on the door, and what you find is all the bugs get attracted to the post, and you'll see more spiders over by the post and less over by the house proper.
Well, we tend to not keep any lights on. We like a clear sky at night to see all these beautiful stars. So
sure.
We don't, other than just in the evening, have some lights on. I suppose the Comet would be best just used to wash the house.
Yeah. I think so. And again, if it does have some repellency, even short term, you'll get it there rather than just sprinkling it along. But
I feel your pain, Bob. Living on the lake, we have these little, and they're just little black sort of spots, and they're hard to get off. They just don't come off very
easy. Well, the other thing, though, Larry, and we've gotten into this before on the show, is that sometimes spiders get accused for things that they're not responsible for.
Well, that's true.
There is a fungus called artillery fungus that shoots these little black spores, and when they land on a house, it's almost like varnish. It just almost welds itself. Very well-defined, round, very hard. And usually you find them more on the north side of the property. You find them more if you've got bark mulch and the like, because what this fungus is associated with a decaying wood. And then it shoots its spores, and as the name artillery fungus, it can shoot them up to 20 to 30 feet. Whereas if I expected it to be spider waste, you know, then it would be up in the corners and the like, usually associated with webbing. And spider waste is a little easier to get off, but still, you know, proteins... Yeah. When they get a chance to meld with paint, give us some problems.
Yeah, they leave by the corner of each window. There's a trail from the ground right up to the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was out washing all day yesterday, so
yeah.
I'll just get more comment.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Bob. And Rick in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I got two bug questions for you.
Okay.
The first one is, we have cedar Adirondack chairs on our deck in the back, and... usually once a night when we're sitting out here, and sometimes a couple, two, three times a night, a black wasp, probably about 3/4 to an inch long, will land on it, and will start stripping down the weathered wood.
Yes.
So it looks like stripes.
Yes.
And you can actually hear them if you're sitting within. In fact, I can see one sitting landing on it right now.
Yeah.
You can actually hear them, you know, gnawing on it, and they're not doing any... major damage. You're just stripping off all the old weathered gray wood on the outside.
Right. And that is the bald-faced hornet that's doing it, and it makes those big basketball-sized paper wasp nests in the tree. And what it's doing is utilizing that chewed-up weathered wood to help make the nest bigger. And because in the spring there's only one or two, you know, the queen and she's starting things out, you don't see it. This is a much more common phenomenon in the late summer. And it's always weathered wood. If that was painted wood, if that was varnished wood, so it's sealed and not weathered, it wouldn't bother with it. But I get the same complaint on cedar fence posts and cedar decks and whatnot that are starting to soften up. So, you know, it makes them look a little unsightly because the difference between the new fresh wood getting exposed and the darker gray weathered wood. But as I said, I mean, it's not a structural issue.
Oh, it's a cosmetic issue. If they're going to do it, I wish they'd do the whole thing or none at all.
Right.
What do you do?
Yeah.
And then the second question I have is, I was at work one day, and I went to pick up some empty crates that we had sitting outside. And when I moved one of the crates, on the very bottom, tucked against the foundation of a building, there was what looked like a June bug. It was about the same size, same shape. I mean, almost identical to it, except it was rust-colored orange, and it had two or three black dots on each one of the sides of the shell.
Right. It's in the same family. We call it the grape leaf beetle or grape pelidnota. That refers to the scientific name. And if you were to turn it over, it has almost a greenish brown or black metallic. I mean, it's a very attractive beetle.
Yeah, it looks iridescent. Looks like a, right. It looks like the Japanese beetle on the bottom.
Yes, and Japanese beetle, to be honest, is in the same family too. So, it, as the name implies, feeds a little bit on grape leaves, never enough to cause much of a problem. The grubs we associate with rotting tree stumps and the like. And the adults are attracted to light like June beetles, and so that's what I wonder what happened. It was a drawn in the building, and then during the day it kind of dropped down to lay low. But I would say they're common, but you never see large numbers anywhere in the state.
Oh, this was the only one that I saw, and he was pretty slow moving. You know, it was around noon, 1 o'clock during the heat of the day. He was fairly slow moving, so I was kind of wondering if he was a nocturnal type insect, and he just kind of went hunkering down there to get out of the sunlight.
Sunlight and get away from the birds.
Now, are those grubs, are those the white, long, with the fat abdomen type grubs?
Yeah, they look just like the grubs in the lawn, maybe just a smidgen bigger. But there are some other ones. I mean, the scarab beetles is a big family. You know, even in the June beetle genus, there's over 130 species in the United States, and there's lots of smaller ones, and there are dung beetles in this group. So it's a very popular group with collectors and very fascinating because of all the different environments. And, you know, some of the neat large beetles you see from the tropics turn out to be in the same family, too. So it is, again, a very well-represented family throughout the world.
Okay, and just one real quick thing, back to that bald-faced hornet. If he's over here chomping on my chairs, what's the proximity possibly of the nest?
Okay, first of all, it's the she. I can guarantee you that. I would guess probably within 100 yards or less. But, you know, that's going to be kind of hard to find because these are often up quite high. In fact, there's a supposedly you can predict the amount of snow by how high the bald-faced hornet nests are every year. you know, there's no truth to this, but it's kind of fun to play around with. So a lot of times, too, it's fascinating. People aren't aware of the nests in their trees until the leaves fall.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had people tell me there was a huge nest just outside their bedroom window all summer long. They never saw them, didn't bother them. But sure enough, when you get into October and we get leaf drop, they become aware of it. But that's about the time the colonies are under major decline. They have no food stores in it to speak of, and so there's no way they can survive the winter. They really starve to death by middle to the end of October in most cases.
And you could maybe you could kind of follow.
Yeah, I mean, you could try to track it. They're quite quick flyers, and so, you know, if it flies straight up.
At least get the direction, yeah.
Yep, and they're just kind of fun to watch. As I said, I'm often amazed the people who've grown up here have never seen this kind of thing before, but when you see them, it is the biggest paper wasp that we typically see here, and it's characteristically jet black with a little bit of a white face to it and a little bit of a whitish cream marking on the ends of the abdomen.
Rick, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Marie emailed us. She's attached a photo of two of thousands of critters very insistent upon entering my parents' basement. There is an exposed entrance to the basement with sliding doors. They seem to get through the edges of the door. Once inside on the carpeting, they seem to desiccate fairly quickly. We've noticed them in years past, but this year the numbers, especially in the last 3 weeks, have increased dramatically. What are they?
Another picture of a millipede. We had talked earlier in the show about it. This is not the typical common species. The most common species is gray, and you can't really see the legs, but this one, the legs are quite easily observed. And what makes it a millipede is they have two pairs of legs for every one of their body segments. So it's a similar story. This one, you do have to be a little careful about bark mulch because the decaying bark mulch, again, is the kind of environment that they would like to breed in. But that's the case in any of these things is try to look to where is there a good source of somewhat damp, consistent organic matter. That's usually where they're coming from. And then, as I said, they're bubbling out at night, kind of wandering through. And coming indoors is an exact mistake for them because nothing to eat, too dry. And that's why we find they die. But again, we go back to the point, if they're finding an easy way in, you know, sometimes it's adjusting door sweeps, sometimes it's caulking areas and whatnot. If you can solve the riddle of how they're squeezing in and keep them out, then it really solves the problem and you can let them do what they need to do. because you can make the argument that they're helping recycle nutrients. I mean, they are an important part of the environment. We just don't want them to come inside the house.
Ben in Minocqua, we're on to you now. Hi, Ben.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Bring you back on the spider subject. We got a house full of spiders. They don't bother me much. I just put them outside when I'm done with them. But, you know, I sometimes get bites. And I wonder if they are from the spiders. And, you know, other people say that after they went for a night's sleep, they said they woke up with a spider bite. And I'm just wondering, around here, what do we got to watch for? Which ones bite?
Well, it's interesting. Entomologically speaking, most of the time when people think they get spider bites, they're not. There's something, some other creature. Spiders by nature. In fact, it's interesting. I was up at the Neville Museum last Wednesday talking about spiders. They have an ongoing spider exhibit and have been bringing speakers in. Mike Draney from Green Bay is going to be up there in a couple weeks, I know. So if you got some interest in spiders or locally around there, that's a thing you should look up. But, you know, we do have black widows here. What's interesting is if you really go hunt for them, you can find them. But I have never in my career of 32 years running the lab or 31 and a half years had somebody bit by a black widow. So, you know, that's not much to be concerned about. A lot of our kind of non-toxic, if you think of them that way, non-poisonous spiders, if you catch them in the right scenario, could bite. But it's kind of like they got to be in your bedroom slipper and you got to almost have to step on them to get bit. I mean, they don't go out of their way to bite you. The other interesting thing, when you think about the spider crawling in your bed on your sheets, if you roll over on him, he's going to bite the sheets, not you. You know, just the way the fangs are located, a lot of spiders don't have big enough fangs to penetrate the skin. They can't get leverage. So that's why I go back to the point. A lot of times when people get mysterious bites, it's not spider. And definitely if it's numerous bites in an area, that's very atypical for spiders.
Right.
True spider bites, often if you look closely, you can see two little puncture marks. We often get, over time, a lot of reddening, maybe a bit of swelling. But a lot of the nasty things that you see on the internet talking about serious reactions to spider bites, it's been found were basically bacterial infections. In fact, MRSA has been pointed at to be often the culprit when we've had all these cases of brown recluse bites diagnosed in Wisconsin. That's not a spider that we officially consider established here. I've only seen four or five cases in my career. But now, again, the research has suggested that a lot of these were MRSA infections. And the problem when you go in the emergency room, if you have an open wound ulcer, you know, a lot of people said, well, that's got to be a spider bite. And that's what they called it. But as they said, what we're finding is a lot of even what we thought were spider bites turned out not to be. So I tend to go looking for other sources first. I once in my life, I was bit by a spider. It was on my shin. The bites are often don't hurt at all. It developed into almost like a small bruise, smaller than the size of a dime. It was there for about 3 or 4 days and then went away. And that one, as I said, there was enough tissue involvement underneath it that it led me to believe it was a spider versus a mosquito or, you know, all the other little things that could take a nip out of you.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Ben, for calling. Appreciate it. And Matt from Brazil emailed us back again and attached a photo of the wasp in question and wonders if you can identify the wasp. And
Oh, my colleague Bob Jean could really give him a good name because Bob works with wasps and has worked in South and Central America. It looks like a group that we would call Polistes. Polistes are an umbrella wasp, the ones that make the little combs that you can see the cells underneath it.
Yeah.
Now, is this in the genus Polistes? Probably not, but it's something closely related. I can tell just because of the structure of the nest. And again, this group in general is predaceous on caterpillars and things like that. So going back to what we had talked about. The other interesting thing is a very nice picture here. I can look in the individual cells and see the eggs or developing grubs already. And that's what this is all about. These wasps, there are the female workers that go out, collect the prey, have to come back, take care of these young. They're totally helpless,
yeah.
You know, without the helping of the adults. So as I said, it's in that group, the Polistes group, which are vespid wasps. This is probably a different species without seeing the color. But as I said, by nature, these tend to be predaceous on larvae of various insects.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri. Mark in Columbus is up next. Mark, hi.
Hi, I've got a question for you. I've got about a 120-year-old home, and what started as a simple project of scraping and painting it this summer became a little more difficult when I had to replace some rotten boards in a sill, and I found a carpenter ant's nest. And the carpenter ants had chewed away at the sill and the rim joist and some of the studs. And I was told that they like to live in an area where it's moist. So I opened up the area, let it dry out for a couple weeks, was able to replace all of the framework with green treated. And I sprayed it several times over the couple of weeks with just a commercial product I had. Then I powdered it before I put the siding back on. I'm wondering if I've done enough and what else I can do before I put the last pieces of trim on to kind of keep the carpenter ants out in the future.
Okay. The issue is if you would have started with a new house with all sound wood and whatnot, you never would have seen it. The ants are looking for a soft substrate. And so very often it is weathered or water-damaged wood they'll get into. And what people misread is not realizing that the wood was already soft and the ants are taking advantage of that rather than the ants eating the wood per se. They make it look like Swiss cheese because they're excavating it, but they're not eating it.
Okay.
Now, you probably solve the problem by just removing the wood alone. You probably solve the problem with the spray. The whole secret to carpenter ants is know where the nest is, and when you spray it, you kill the queen, and you've shut them down. They've got no way to recoup from that. So you've done more than enough, and I wouldn't worry about the trim. Now, the other thing, because of the age of the house, you're always going to be a little bit of prone to have the right environments just because over that period of time, wood often will weather.
Sure.
So anything you're doing to prevent that process will be good. But I've also seen the ants get real tricky. I mean, I've seen them take advantage of pre-existing void spaces. So I've seen them nesting in hollow core doors. I've seen them nesting in hollow curtain rods. So there often are places they'll move into. And once they move in there, they like to keep the humidity up when they're raising their young in particular. So that's why it's quite common if you've got a carpenter ant nest in the house in February, the ants are showing up in the kitchen. They have no interest in food. What they're doing is stealing water to bring back to the nest to kind of get the humidities up. And so you kind of address it. You know, if you start to see a spot where the paint's chipping off or peeling because there's too much moisture, don't be surprised to see an ant colony in that kind of situation. But the thing that I tell people a lot nowadays is I wish we didn't call them carpenter ants because the perception is that they're very destructive. And as I said, when you really get down to it, I can make the argument the water has been very destructive, but the ants are just kind of taking advantage of a situation more than anything else.
Even that will be keeping that area dry. Now, as I'm working on the opposite side of the house, I've been noticing a lot of ants on the siding, but they're not nearly as big as the ants from the other nest on the front of the house. Is that something to worry about? Would that be a different type of ant that's coming out of my flower bed?
Yeah. Hard to say, although it generally works if the ants are showing an interest in being in the house or on the house and they're middle-sized or bigger in either black or black and red in color, there'll be a carpenter ant. But the argument I make is I can find them on any property. I mean, because there's always dead tree stumps and limbs and whatnot, hollow trees. There's carpenter ants all over the place. And so it's kind of the pattern. And, you know, the other thing that makes it a little deceptive is they're more active at night than they are in the day. If the pattern was you saw a bunch of ants crawling in the house, but they always seem to crawl upwards and get in the overhang, then you probably got another nest, is what that would suggest. If you just got a few ants cruising around, they have to forage for food, and so they're out there all the time anyway. The patterns, you know, when you see them, if you see them at any time it's too cold for the ants to be active, that's suspicious and the like. So it's worth just keeping your eyes open. I as I said, it's hard to say for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if those were carpenter ants. It's just a question, are they nesting indoors or out? A trick we've talked about on the show before is to get some honey or other sweet things that they kind of like, put it out on a plate, you know, pie plate, and come back at night, about 10 o'clock at night with a flashlight. And what I want to see is a bunch of ants, but the ants, aside from being clustered around the honey, are going to come and go, and then you can track them. And
okay.
What you find is half the time you'll track them back to a tree stump, and it could even be on the neighbor's yard.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, as I said, the pattern is they're all crawling up the siding, and then we know there's someplace up high in the house.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Mark. And Luba and Madison, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question on ID of insect.
Sure.
And it's about 5/8 inches long, basic color orange, underside, narrow horizontal black and orange stripes, and on the top, two black stripes, one on each wing type area. And two black spots on the head area.
Sure. I think it's a soldier beetle. We had a call earlier, and
sounds like it.
They're very common on flowers right now. In fact, usually you'll see them clustered or mating, and they said the giveaway to me is that, you know, people describe it as a golden to yellowish orange color, but the two black dots towards the tip of the abdomen, they're kind of elongated critters, and then the mm-hmm. little dots up in front, and then the final giveaway is they have long thin black antennae. They don't have any clubs or knobs or those kind of things on it, so that would all fit. Now, if you gave me this description in May, I'd be confused because I don't see soldier beetles until we get well into July, but then they seem to hang out all the way into September.
And are they destructive?
No, they feed on pollen. And so you'll usually see them on, you know, blooming daisies, that kind of thing, but nothing to worry about.
All okay, right. Great. Thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. And Jim in Waukesha, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Great. Could you identify the beetle that is wreaking havoc with our pole bean leaves? We are right now taking a small plastic cup with a little ammonia in the bottom and just knocking them off into the cup. Is that the only way to get rid of these things?
I think you have Japanese beetle, because Japanese beetle has a real fondness for pole beans versus bush beans. And when you have herds of them on there, and that's the way Japanese beetles work, the problem with that insect, among other things, is they are very good at coming from off property. And so most of the time, the misery we have has nothing to do with what's going on in your yard. But what makes life so frustrating for all of us that have to deal with it is that they're flying for 2.5 months. And so it's a very extended period of time. And you can hand pick them. And what the research tells us is that the hand picking will reduce the population by 50% per day on the plant. So you're gaining on them, but you got to expect new beetles to come in every day. Mm. As far as protections, there are chemicals that will knock them down. A chemical that we've talked about before on the show for, you know, things that are fruit production or vegetables, there's an organic insecticide called neem oil. It is more of an anti-feedant. It isn't the total answer, but it tends to like to keep the beetles off for 2 to 3 days, 3 to 4 days, you know. And so if you get tired of hand-picking, that would be a way of convincing them to leave the pole beans away. Are you controlling the population? No. What you're doing is protecting your beans, but
right. That's
what we're after here. And
yeah, exactly.
The other thing is that the beans can probably tolerate about 20% leaf loss without affecting yield. So the damage, in some sense, is cosmetic as long as they keep away from the pods and the like. And they tend to be more, you know, what's characteristic is you've probably seen they have a real dainty way of feeding. It's kind of a lacy chewing that goes on, and that's very classic Japanese beetle.
And it's all pretty much near the top of the poles too.
Yeah, they like stuff high on linden trees. You'll always see them work on the top down, and you'll also see them work the sunny side, you know, and the shade side of plants. They're far less interested. Have been overall statewide, I would say, down this year. But what we find with this thing, because it's been moving in the state for about the last 12 to 15 years or so, but the areas that it's just moving into are where we see it do the most damage. And the nice thing about those of us on the west side of Madison, especially the near west side, not the far west side, is we've seen about a 60 to 70% drop in the population the last 2 years, which is suggesting that it's coming into more of a natural balance, which we've heard about this happening in other states I'm starting to see it happen here, but as I said, people that just got Japanese beetle for the first time have got a few years of misery before I think things get better.
Do they also affect knockout roses?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
You know,
okay.
Roses,
they love them.
Roses, birches, lindens, grapes, raspberries are all on the top of their list, but again, another biological trait that makes them a real devil of an insect is they feed on over 300 varieties of plants. And so you will see a difference, though. Different color roses they're less attracted to. I always tell the story in my backyard. They eat the white flowers of my some of my plants and not the purple, you know, same variety, clematis in particular. So you can start playing around. At least if you see something they don't like as much, that may be something in the future you decide to plant more often. And as I said, the difference between pole beans and bush beans, I know that they just love pole beans, and you'll see a lot less activity on bush beans.
And what did you say the chemical was again?
Well, the one that I would consider is neem, N-E-E-M.
Okay.
There's also another organic insecticide called spinosad. The label is pretty broad. I'd read it first to make sure beans are on it. It's very similar. It's an organic product that gives us 3 or 4 days of control, whereas some of the more synthetic chemicals can go upwards of 8 to 10 days. But the problem there is you want to harvest the things, and that often gets in the way. So
yeah, right.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Jen in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Okay, I'll make this real quick because I know you're short. I'm an avid bug watcher all my life, and I don't know necessarily identify them, but I love watching them. They're beautiful. This summer, I saw a bug I've never seen before. I found out it was a bee, and it is absolutely stunning. It is green as can be, the brightest metallic green you've ever seen. The whole body, the wings are transparent and brown and thin. The whole thing is no bigger than a half an inch, very thin. And I just can't believe this is the first time I've seen one in 55 years of looking at bugs.
To be honest, there's more than one family of very bright bees. Cuckoo bees or cuckoo wasps are outstanding under a microscope. In fact, even have some blue helicted bees are another group. When you start looking close at insects, there's really an awful lot of neat stuff to look at. It's just that most people have a hard time getting that close. But as I said, some of the stuff under a microscope is as sculptured and nice as any piece of jewelry you've ever seen.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. All our lines are filled and we have many emails. Email from Coco in Arcadia, Phil, who's writing, wants to know, what should I do with red ants on my counter kitchen tops? I've tried cleaning with vinegar, bleach, but they appear again at over time. They form like a good trail from the wall and find them under some stuff on the counters. Try not to put food on the counters like fruit or jam or butter. I try to hide as much. But they try to hide as much as she tries to hide as much of that as possible. Any simple suggestions?
Well, for this type of thing, if the ants have got the habit of coming indoors, and this sounds like outside ants that are coming in for food, one of two things. I like the idea of baiting them. The whole idea is that we'll take food back and it will destroy the colony. What you have to pay attention to is what their food preference is. Is it sugar and sweet things or is it protein? And then buy the appropriate baits. The other thing, and this is more of a cosmetic treatment, is because we know they're coming from outside, is not to spray indoors, because that's really, they're already there, but to spray along the outside foundation with an ant spray. And what it does is it repels them really more than kills them, so they stop coming in. So I like the idea of the baits. It honestly uses less pesticides and less toxic pesticides and really approaches the problem directly. But as I said, you got to tweak this a little bit because I get the calls all the time. I bought a bait. It doesn't work. Well, you know, if you buy a sugar bait for a protein feeding ant, it won't work. My guess is that these are probably going to be sugar-based types of ants. I wonder if it's cornfield ant because they're little red ones, and that would describe
that's
them.
That's what it sounds like. Paula in Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Paula.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a cabin in northern Dunn County. I know it's too far north, supposedly, for the emerald ash borer, but twice I've seen these beautiful green insects about a quarter of an inch long on our deck. And the insect is so beautiful, it truly could be in a ring on your finger. It really looks like an emerald. What is it?
Okay. I mean, there's a number of things it could be. And this is the thing is, it's good that people recognize that emerald ash borer is a brilliant green insect. But we've got tiger beetles, we've got the beetles, a couple of blister beetles that fit that category. I've got a number of wasp species that are brightly green colored. So I would have to see more of what it is. And most likely it's not emerald ash borer. It's one of these native insects that have very similar coloration.
You're not likely to see them on your porch.
The interesting thing is with all that's been going on, although there's been beetles caught in traps in Green Bay and Kenosha recently, but really the finds are typically more that the ash trees are dying and they see the D-shaped holes or they see the galleries underneath as identifying it rather than expecting to see the green beetle. I'll tell you, all the green beetles, and I've seen a number of them in the last two or three years that have been sent in have turned out to be, as they said, some of these native green critters in not emerald ash borer.
Well, that's wonderful to know, but it was the most beautiful bug I've ever seen.
Oh, well, thanks very much for calling. And you might, Phil, she could maybe go to your online to your insect diagnostic.
Yeah. You know, I have an ID section according to with my website, but, you know, I always warn people it's not all inclusive. We've got 18,000 species in the state, and what I've tried to do is put either the more common big scary looking things or the more common pest species. What I don't have a good representation of is a lot of the big, just pretty insects and whatnot. And there are other sites. You know, one of my favorite sites is one called Bug Guide that has all kinds of pictures. But I think the problem for that is if you don't know what you're looking for, you're just looking for a green bug, you're not going to find it. If you knew that you were looking for a cuckoo bee and you did it, it would have the pictures of all the North American cuckoo bees, and you could kind of look through there. So it has its uses, but you kind of have to know what you're looking for.
Okay. Thanks, Paula, for calling. Ross in Whitefish Bay, on to you now. Hi, Ross.
Hi. I'm a high school student. I was interested in collecting and preserving some bugs. What would be some easy ways to collect and preserve bugs from real big ones down to little teeny tiny mealy-type bugs?
Well, typically anything that's got any kind of decent shell to it, you know, beetles and the like, all we do is you know, put them on the insect pins, and they preserve themselves. The thing about when you're mounting insects, though, when you catch them fresh, they're a lot easier to work with. Over time, if you know, they die, they become very brittle, and then you can't, in the case of butterflies and moths, can't move the wings. For very soft-bodied things and things like caterpillars and the like, the immature stages, most typically we put stuff in alcohol to preserve it. The problem is that if you let those dry, they just kind of all shrivel up. So, you know, most adult insects, we just use the insect pins, which are an inch and a half long. To get those, you can look at, there's various biological supply companies, one called BioQuip out of California. It's probably a good site. And you can order the pins, and they come in different sizes, although most of the time I'd say a pin around a number 2 or a number 3 size would be appropriate for most Wisconsin insects. For the real tiny ones, the trick we use is we use a little card punch that makes a little piece of cardboard or cardstock, kind of stiff paper, make a little triangle. So the pin goes through the cardstock, and then the little point of it, we put a little tiny piece of glue and mount, you know, little tiny flies and little leaf hoppers and like that. So it's called point pound or mounting, and that works quite well. You know, the thing is, when you identify insects, you want to see as many sides of the body as you can. And so that's why, you know, you try to be careful on how you mount things and don't break legs and whatnot, because often those things are important when we identify them. And there's some good stuff on the internet on, you know, collecting and such. But the interesting thing, as I said, is you don't have to do much special. Sometimes what a lot of us will do is when we are out collecting in the summer and things are too busy to mount, I'll take the specimens and put them in a Cool Whip or similar plastic container and put them in the freezer. When they're still fresh, when I take and thaw them out, they'll still be supple. I can mount them and do this in the middle of the winter when I've got time. You know, in the case of butterflies, you want the wings spread out, and you got to put them on a mounting board and let them, you know, dry for about a week or so. But nothing special other than that, as I said. And there's even some ways in beetles, if they get all brittle, you can put them in some relatively hot water for a minute or so, and they'll soften her up so you can move the legs and move the antennae in case you want to do that. And if you need any more information, just, you know, email me. As I said, I'm sure I probably can come up with some websites that go into more detail, because, you know, most of the time when you talk about technically, you know, we want to label it in a very specific way so that information will be useful in case people want to look at the specimens in the future.
All right. And you're
all right, thanks.
Yeah, and you can just go to the Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Right, or the Department of Entomology under faculty and staff. I'm staff with the Insect Diagnostic Lab, and get my email and email me that way.
All right. Good luck, Russ. Thanks very much for calling. Fran in Green Bay, up to you now. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I've got a problem.
Okay.
I've got a flower problem because I have white flower that had little tiny skinny brown insects in it yesterday.
Oh, now, are you talking about flour as in flour for baking?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are two or three what we call flower beetles. There's a red flower beetle, a confused flower beetle, a sawtooth grain beetle. And it's hard to say if it came in with the flour or it came in with some other kind of food from the grocery store. But, you know, flour, because it sits around for such a long period of time, is always capable of getting infested. In fact, you know, one of the worries is often you buy it, there's no true bugs in there, but all there needs to be is a couple eggs on the outside of the package. And then 6 weeks later, we got two adult bugs and they have offspring. So these things take time to evolve.
So you think I could have brought them in?
One way or another, yes, you brought it in, but you could have brought it in on birdseed, pet food, you know, other items. And then the problem when we get it in the kitchen is that they're very good at getting in other packaging, and so it's kind of like chasing them around. So the thing that I would advise you now is most likely you want to throw out things that are infested. Things that are not infested, you can throw in the freezer for a couple nights. That would kill what's ever there. But things like flour.
But then what do I do with it? I mean, I don't want to eat it.
No, but see, you know, if let's say you had a box of pancake batter that you hadn't opened yet, you weren't sure. By freezing it, you'd stop any activity. When you finally open it up, if it's got critters in, you throw it out. That's fine.
But
what I don't want you to do is throw everything in the kitchen out when it turns out it might be one package of noodles and one box of flour that has the problem. The thing you got to be careful of now is because these things wander around for a while, is to put things that you're going to have around for a period of time in a container they can't get into, screw top jars, plastic containers. The bottom line is a package of flour is just a, you know, thick paper and glue that won't keep them out. So again, the flour, putting it in some kind of tin container and whatnot, so it's contained. So that will protect other insects from coming in, infesting that. If you missed it and there's some in there, you've got them contained. They can't escape. And so, as I said, a little bit of cleanup and a little bit of adjusting in how you package things, and you should be able to beat it. I always argue it's not effective to spray for this, because if you don't throw the bad box of Bisquick out, you can spray all you want and you still got bugs. It's the sanitation and then, I said, kind of protecting things to make sure they don't get reinfested. The interesting thing about the insects is the flower beetles in the adult stage are very long-lived for insects. We're talking 7 to 8 months, up to maybe as much as 14 months. And so what we're trying to protect against is the ones that you don't get that are wandering around the kitchen. They don't find something else to get in and start this whole cycle over.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And David in Mountain, we turn to you. Hi, David.
Good morning or afternoon. Hey, I had a question. Are walking sticks, are they destructive and or like pests, or are those just bugs that hang out naturally in nature?
Once in a great while, we get tremendous numbers, and they'll defoliate oak trees. I also find them feeding on raspberries, but just the leaves. And so most of the time, I would say they're definitely not pests. They're kind of interesting little things. We have three common species and one uncommon species in the state. So we even have four different kinds of walking sticks, which is kind of fun. And I just think they're neat critters to look at. And as I said, I really don't worry, because I've only once in my career seen an outbreak, and that was up in the Baraboo Hills of walking sticks, and that's been about 15, 20 years. And the oaks recovered. It was just 1 year of a few oak leaves on the trees.
Okay, and I plan on keeping it as a pet, actually. what would I feed it? Besides raspberries, because those aren't available in the winter.
Well, see, that's the problem is that our common species are basically oak feeders, and we run out of oak leaves once the leaves fall. Now, some of the tropical species that I've seen, our graduate students have been rearing one of the tropical species, they can feed it lettuce, and that's acceptable. My guess is you can try the lettuce, but as I said, I seem to think that the ones that we have in Wisconsin have to have oak leaves or they're not happy.
All right. Okay. All right, thanks a lot for calling. Catherine wonders how to get rid of landscape wasps.
Well, things that disappear in the ground, you know, we have these paper wasps that will nest in old rodent burrows or washed out places under slabs, the same ones that get into the siding of people's houses. If you can't see the nest, but that you can see the hole where they're coming and going from, it's a dust. Doesn't matter what the dust is. You can buy 7 Garden Dust, Permethrin, Delta Methrin. You know, there's a number of those products out there. Wait until 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night when things are quieted down. Dust the entrance, and that will do them in. And what it is when they come and go through it, they honestly get the dust on their bodies. So it's kind of a spot treatment. If you try the aerosol sprays, or people use gasoline and a bunch of other kind of sometimes crazy things, and they get very poor performance and honestly are in some cases, you know, more polluting than any insecticide I can come up with. And so, as I said, that's my secret. If I can't see the nest, I use the dust. If I can see the nest, it's these gray paper wasp nests. Then the aerosol wasp sprays that you get at the hardware or landscape store would be the way to go.
Chris in Minocqua emailed and said, can you please tell me what the large bugs are in some pine logs we have in the backyard? I can hear them chewing through the wood. Is there a way to get rid of them without harming the wood? Because we want to make that wood into, usable timber.
Okay. The critter is called a pine sawyer beetle. It's a longhorned wood borer, and it's characteristic of what you say. Makes a lot of noise. Will leave a big hole. Unfortunately, once it's in the wood, the only way I know to get rid of it is to put the logs under water. For an extended period of time, or to fumigate them, and that's not going to be practical. Now, the bottom line is they will leave some holes a little bit bigger than a pencil. They'll leave a little bit of sawdust, but they cannot recycle in the wood. So what you got is what you got. It's not going to get worse over time. And so if you want to use the logs, it's fine, but realize you will have some cosmetic injury associated with it. The only way to stop them is basically to have the logs sprayed before the bugs show up, and it's too late for that.
Susie in Genesee says, I have two bald-faced hornet nests on my one-acre lot, one in the backyard just above the crotch of a maple and the second in the front yard about a foot off the ground in a lilac bush. This low-lying nest is getting heavy and nearly touching the ground. Does this mean we're going to have no snow this year?
Well, that's the way I would read it. So that sounds real good.
Well, seriously, she says, my husband is concerned about mowing near the lilac. How far away must he stay?
Ooh. You know, just like honeybees, you know, anybody who's kept bees will tell you that their temperament depends on the day. Good sunny day, they're pretty mild-mannered. After a couple cloudy days, they get a little grumpy. Bald-faced hornet has a little bit of that going on. I normally find, you know, I think a little bit is how noisy is the lawnmower. Because the more vibration and whatnot, the farther away you've got to be. I find most of the time I can be at least 10, 12 feet and maybe more. And so this is going to be a judgment call. It may be that you're not, if you can get away with not mowing around the lilac, that would be one solution. The other one is if he really does feel he has to mow, this may be a nest that has to be destroyed. It's just, again, the risk that you take. As I said, 10, 12 feet, I would try it. Part of it is maybe just start with a lawnmower and start going towards them and just see how they behave and see when they start to get agitated. But as I said, you may find after a couple cloudy days, if they haven't been out to get food, they may be a little bit grumpier.
Here's an interesting one. Carrie from Centuria emails, hi, we have a basketball-sized wasp nest in our house in the basement above the ceiling tile. What can we do to get rid of it safely?
Well, again, this very often could be one of these ground nesting forms. And so somewhere from the outside, there is an entrance where they're coming and going. Once that's identified, that's what you want to treat. You would treat with one of these dusts. The other option, though, is to let them be, because they will freeze out. You know, if they haven't bothered you yet, that's encouraging, although you don't want to go pounding on that false ceiling and get them all riled up. The biggest mistake I see people make is sometimes they will see the opening and they'll plug it before they deal with the wasps. And then, honestly, you force them to come out in every other place in the house, and they're often very agitated, so that would not be a good way to go. I suppose if you know where the nest is, you could also kindly, calmly push up the ceiling panel adjacent to it and use one of the aerosol sprays. But I think that's a little riskier. As I said, yeah. I would go on the outside of the house, just sit there and observe, and you should be able to see an area of a lot of activity where they're coming and going. Then you know what site you need to treat.
And let's see, we have James was just wondering about a bug he saw in his bathroom that looked like a tick with two big crab claws. I think it was called a Poseidon scorpion. Anything good or bad about this bug?
Pseudoscorpion is what we would call him. It's a group of animals, you know, that are separate, like a millipede is and the like. They eat carpet beetles and other little beasties in the house, so they're very beneficial, and they can't hurt people. So nothing to worry about there.
Okay, let's turn to Neil in Heartland. Hi, Neil.
Hi. I got a question about a fly I saw. I was working in the yard, and all of a sudden this buzz came by, it landed on the wheelbarrow, and this thing was huge. I mean, it was a lot bigger than a horsefly I've ever seen. It had to be about at least an inch to an inch and a half long and quite stout, about maybe close to a half an inch wide. All black, and it looked like a fly. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Two things. There is one giant horsefly in the state called the black horsefly. It is five times bigger than any horsefly you've ever seen. And so that would be my first guess. And they look like a stealth bomber, very big eyes on it. If it was that size range but not quite as bulky, there's a whole family of something that we call robber flies. Robber flies are predators. In fact, they go out and collect all kinds of things, other flies, honeybees, bumblebees, you name it, they'll go after it, even dragonflies. But the way I would describe them is they're more long and skinny in most cases, and they're really quite hairy in appearance. So it has to be one of the two, but my first guess is if you do an internet search on the black horsefly, you see this big black dark-winged creature. And interesting enough, they don't seem to pick on people, but boy, horses get very, very concerned when they're around, because you can imagine the bite would be pretty impressive.
Thanks again for calling. Pete from Wales emailed. He said, I've heard a lot about neem, N-E-E-M, to date, but I haven't been able to find it in stores. Does it go by under another name, or is it incorporated in another product?
You will find neem oil extracts identified as such. they do have some purified forms of it that go under the name, or the purified form is called azadirachtin. So I've seen it sold as azatin, azatol, A-Z-A-T-I-N would be a name. If in doubt, it's easy to find on the internet. If you go to Gardens Alive, which is a company that specializes in organic stuff, they would have it. But interesting enough, in the larger stores, you know, locally, Jung's, I see it on the shelf, you know, it's interesting that a lot of chemical companies are now starting to come out with green or organic products. In fact, it was interesting, there was a representative from the Bayer company in our department a couple days ago, and they have the product that we use against emerald ash borer, among other things, but they're coming out with a whole product line of natural products too, as is Ortho. And so you'll see more and more of these formulations. Doesn't control all insects, unfortunately, but it definitely is a tool that we can use. And again, one of the advantages, is, aside from being organic, is it can be used in a lot of fruit and vegetables without much harvest restriction.
Nick in Wind Point, we're on to you now. Hi, Nick.
Hey, thanks. Okay, here's the problem. I've got some kind of a bug that's attacking my vegetables in my garden. I've checked in the evening trying to find it, in the morning trying to find it, throughout the daytime. And what it's doing is, if you can imagine a melon scoop that is extremely tiny, it scoops out a little, like, area in the fruit or vegetable, and then it leaves the rest of it, and then the vegetable rots. You got any ideas? I can't seem to figure out what it is.
Boy, you can't rule out slugs, because slugs eat little gouges like that into things. And then, of course, once you open up the fruit, it becomes susceptible to secondary infections. What in particular are you getting the most problems on?
Let's see, potatoes, spicy peppers, and strawberries.
And is it in all cases just the fruit, not the leaves?
Well, the potato got some leaves attacked, but everything else, the leaves seem to be fine.
Yeah, I would lean towards slugs.
You think slugs then, huh? Yep, any specific creature I can get for the garden to take care of it organically, or?
Well, you know, the slug bait that's considered organic is iron phosphate.
It's
a pelleted bait you put out there. There are also some synthesized baits like the slug gettas or bug gettas that tend to be methaldehyde based. You know, you can promote toads. You can promote some species of fireflies. To be honest, their larvae are predators on slugs. You know, there's the home remedies of using the beer baits, although those have to be refreshed. So there's a number of adjustments, but basically if things are lush, the slugs do well. If things are dry, they don't.
Okay.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling. And let's see, we've got Chris here who wants you to comment on earwigs, what to do about them. They're in the house, the basement, but they crawl upstairs at night and under my plants, the container baskets on the deck and so forth.
Well, things should be kind of winding down with earwigs. I mean, they've been out since about the 1st of June, and usually by this time of the year, I've seen their numbers drop. Indoors is a dead end for them. They can't breed there. They can't live that long there, but they will tend to congregate under things. My solution, which people don't like, is you make your backyard a sandbox and you will not have earwigs.
Yeah.
Because you've created an environment they won't live in, but they basically do well in lush vegetable gardens, mulched areas, that thing, and they sneak indoors by accident. So that's where we put up the fight. If you're going to treat, you treat the mulched areas. You also look at how they might be squeezing in and do it there. Indoors, other than vacuuming them up, I wouldn't mess with them.
Phil, always a pleasure. That we've answered a million questions today, it seems like.
Well, tis the season.
Tis the season. You'll be back again.
About a month.
Yeah, about a month. We'll do this again. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest, and he'll be back in about a month, and we'll do this again. Sorry we didn't get to everyone. Just to let you know what's coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking with Joe Rhodes of Madison about Apple computers and Apple accessories. That's at 11 o'clock, and Joe's been a regular for a while. And then at 11:45, are you planning to fly anywhere? Well, if you're looking for bargain airfares, Rick Cini of FareCompare.com joins us at 11:45 to talk about those fares. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.